Let's remember together some of the greatest TV and movie stars of yesteryear with the woman who knew them. Mary Jane Popp hosted radio and TV shows for nearly 5 decades, meeting these stars and getting them to share their real-life stories. You'll meet them up close and personal as Mary Jane searches her extensive archives for the best and brightest real star talk on Pop Star Talk. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
Hi, Mary Jane Popp here with another edition of Pop Star Talk. And my producer, Ken Sigourney-Knoll, and I always love to share a surprise or two in every pop star segment. And this one is a winner. You'll know why when I tell you his career debuted in a movie in 1972 that made an incredible impact on moviegoers. Here's the opening scene from, you guess which movie it was.
Schlachthof 5. This is Schlachthof 5. 5 is English 5. Schlacht is slaughter. Hof is house. Schlachthof 5. Slaughterhouse 5. Your house.
From that debut movie in Slaughterhouse 5, there was no stopping Perry King. With his good looks and great talent, he went on to do The Lords of Flatbush, Mandingo. He was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for his role in the TV movie The Hasty Heart. And the same year, he landed the role of Cody Allen on the popular TV series Riptide. And here's our surprise on Pop Star Talk. Instead of playing bits of his life from the past, I wanted you to meet him up close and personal. Perry, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us, and thank you for being such a good friend so many years.
Thank you, Mary Jane. I just always love seeing you, talking to you. It's always a joy. You're always a joy.
Well, right back at you. So, Ken, this is a man that is unbelievable in what he's done. You've done movies. You've done television. What stands out in your mind after all the years that you've done this work, since 1972, for God's sakes, what stands out in your life more than anything else?
Well, professionally, a couple things. Maybe being on Broadway, I was on Broadway in A Few Good Men, playing Nathan Jessup, you know. You can't handle the truth. And that was by far the hardest work I've ever done in my life. Being on stage on Broadway makes everything else look easy by comparison. But my favorite thing is the movie I made most recently called The Divide, up on The Divide. That's the name we give the area where my personal cattle ranch, I have a cattle ranch, got really lucky, and I own a 500-acre cattle ranch in an area called The Divide, close to the American River. And we made a movie up there.
Before you do, tell us a lot, you know, really how it all came together. I want people to hear about your movie and the cowboys, and you did just that. It was called, as you said, The Divide. So I thought we should hear a clip of Sam Kincaid and then find out how it all came about.
One thing I'd like to forget is the only thing I seem to remember.
What the hell are you doing out here?
We know the owner.
Does he look like me?
Get out of here.
Working around here? I'm working at the Kincaid Ranch. Been there about a month or so.
Stop standing around. Damn it, fire you.
You gotta understand why the holes are there in the first place.
Yeah. You may need stitches.
Your father's Sam Kincaid, right? You're his daughter, Sarah?
I don't have a daughter. Why do you think I have a daughter?
Keep your head still. Any confusion?
He's forgetful sometimes. Is there a chance Sam could have had an injury before?
Sarah?
You know, I'm the one who's supposed to be angry.
Who's this?
My son.
My mom always told me you were her hero.
Damn it! You don't give an inch, do you?
Don't you ever do that in front of my kid again.
I need to show you something. Does this most nights.
need help.
Wait.
What?
Don't you go in there. It's not safe in there. There's ghosts in that barn. What the hell are you doing in here?
I was just looking.
Get out. Get out. Get out. Get out.
How's old Sam been treating you?
Yeah, he picked me up on the side of the road. I needed a place to stay. He needed a hand.
Do you want some advice?
I'd get the hell out of here.
Wow. Perry, you got to tell him the story behind The Divide, because that was always in the back of your mind, maybe a dream, whatever, that you wanted to make a movie about cowboys. But this was different, completely different. It was based in what, 1973?
77, actually, which was the last big drought California had right before the most recent severe drought of around the time of 2015, I think it was. But 1977 was the last big drought. And this is a movie, the way it evolved was it became a movie about drought. Drought of the land, but drought of your life and drought of your mind. Specifically, Alzheimer's, which in 1977, nobody really knew anything about. And if you think back to that time, nobody used that phrase. Nobody heard that term, Alzheimer's. Maybe you talked about dementia. Mostly people would just talk about, oh, yeah, he's losing it. He's getting soft. That's about all that people said. Nowadays, Alzheimer's is a major threat to everyone. Yeah. And it's hard to say why. There's a lot of theories about it. But my own theory is it's this simple. Medical science has gotten so good that our lives have gotten much longer. Men, you know, Ken, you tell me this, if this isn't true, it's men routinely, both my grandfathers were dead quite several years before they got to be the age I am right now. And I have every reason to expect I got another 15 years or something left. So medical science has allowed us to literally live and outlive our brains is a simplistic way to put it. So anyway, this is a movie about Alzheimer's. But what I love about that is, and again, this wasn't our intention. It just evolved this way. A movie sort of develops its own life. It's the only movie about Alzheimer's I know that has a positive ending, an upbeat, uplifting ending. Not because we cheated or made it that way, but it just ended up being that way. And I think that's why it touches people so much, because my character suffers from Alzheimer's, but, and you got to see the movie to know why, he's not beaten by it.
No.
He kind of makes a weird, in a weird way, he wins with it. He wins against it. Anyway, I always loved cowboys. A little boy, and practically every little boy my, you know, who's grown up, every man my age can tell you the same story, but I grew up just loving cowboys. I mean, today, my favorite thing to do is sit down and watch old black and white Gunsmokes. It's so satisfying. Oh. The things I grew up with, you know, every old guy says that, I think. And when I was a little boy, my father, who was a doctor, his father, Perry King, had been a doctor, but he never pushed his sons to be doctors. He was wonderful. He just said, find something to do you love so much, you do it for free. And then he said, and then figure out how to pay your bills with it. Which is just great advice. Great advice. I've given it to hundreds of thousands of people. But anyway, so I'd watch these Westerns and I thought, that's what I want to do. That's what I, oddly enough, I could never get Westerns. When I was younger, I was very pretty. I wasn't really handsome. I was pretty. And I think I just didn't fit in Westerns. Now, of course, I'm an old man and I've solved that problem.
I love it.
So I finally thought, you know, when we were looking about for a good friend of mine, Janet Brown, and I, she's a writer, and we were talking, we wanted to do something together. We said, let's make a movie. Let's write a film script. And we wrote a couple others and worked hard on them, but discarded them when we finally just said, this won't work. And I said, well, let's write a Western because that's what I want to do. I want to be a cow. I want to get to play a cowboy. I'd only ever gotten the chance once before in a movie called The Cowboy and the Movie Star to do it with Sean Young. Wonderful experience shooting it, but, you know, a kind of run-of-the-mill TV movie. And we wrote it to fit my land, what I own in Northern California, a 500-acre cattle ranch. We use my property because I thought, if we do that, I'll never have a fight with the landowner, right?
Yeah. You'd have clear title pretty easily on that one.
Yeah.
Perry, I don't think people realize you were the producer, the director, and the star. I mean, and Ken, you'll understand this story because Ken does the same thing. But really? You were did it all. Why?
Well, because it's the only way I could do what I wanted to do, which is I wanted just once to do something, make a movie, my movie. And I'd always had this dream to make my own movie, but to do it my way. You know, that old cliche, but boy, because I'd worked so many times with directors, good directors often, but directors would want something that I thought was not the right choice. And unlike a lot of actors, I believe the actor's job is to help the director tell his story, his and the screenwriter's story. So you don't fight with them. You give them what they want. It's they're the captain of the ship. But I wanted to be the captain of the ship. And the only way to do that was to, frankly, mainly pay for it myself. So by the time I got to be an old man, I finally had enough money set aside that I could just make my own movie. And, you know, and so often on a daily experience on the set for me was saying to someone, they'd say, no, we shouldn't do this. This is wrong. And I say, look, when you make your movie, you do it that way. But this is my movie and we're going to do it my way.
I love
and I made a lot of guys mad. You know?
Really?
Interestingly, one of the many lessons I had from making that movie, many, many lessons, but one of them, powerful lesson is, hire women. All the people who worked for me on that movie in every department, including the line producer, who was wonderful. I mean, just so many great people. But all the women who worked for me helped me do what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. Four or five of the guys and I just butted heads so severely. They couldn't stand the fact that I was in charge. You know, they wanted to be in charge. And I'd say, figure out how to be in charge of something else, man. This is mine. And I'm doing it. It's in black and white, for example. And everybody said, no, you can't make black and white. You can't do it. And I said, well, too bad. I'm doing it. That's what I want to be.
Ken, did some of this sound familiar?
Oh, very familiar. Did you shoot film or did you shoot video?
No, I shot video and straight to hard drive, too, which is wonderful because it gives you it's so cheap relative to film. I mean, all my young life as an actor, it was a big deal to ask for an extra take because of all the film stock, you know, and those huge Panavision cameras staring at you and everything. With the new equipment these days, it's amazing what you can do. We shot a lot of the time, for example, with a Sony A7 camera that may be outmoded today. I don't know. This is a few years ago that we shot, but it was so sensitive. One scene we lit entirely with a flashlight that my character Sam held in his hand. And I was lighting the scene as I'm acting at it, literally moving the flashlight around so that it would catch people's faces at the right time in the scene and stuff. I mean, the camera was so sensitive to light, which is, you know, incredible when you think of the old equipment, that the light on the back of the camera, a little tiny red light, would ruin the shot. We'd had to tape it over so that nobody could see it because it would kill the shot. I mean, back in the 30s and 40s, they had a lot of actors used to get eye damage from the brightness of the arc lights that they had to use. Now we've come around full circle where you can point new cameras at what looks like a pitch black vista and it will see stuff, you know?
I had a studio up in Sacramento and we rented equipment. And now it amazes me, you know, what we were paying $35,000 and $9,000 for the lens and all that. Yeah. I can shoot with an iPhone and the quality is better.
Absolutely. You know, the who was it? Sex, Lives, and Videotape. Who's that director? Soderbergh. Steven Soderbergh. I read that somewhere that he said his next movie, he's going to shoot on an iPhone. Next big multi-million dollar movie. He's going to shoot it on an iPhone. He said it's the best camera out there. Why not use it?
Right. Uh-huh. I'm now shooting. My son-in-law's a director of photography, and he shot a film for a gentleman named John Putch, who is Singleton's son. And it's an Alzheimer film also. You should see it. It's called The Father and the Bear. And they shot it with a Canon 35-millimeter camera that shot video.
Uh-huh.
It's a beautiful shot film.
Yeah, yeah. We also had a camera on the set that we used a lot. But I bought the equipment to shoot the movie for way less than I would have rented the equipment for 10, 15 years before. Right. But here's the thing that I don't like about modern technology. On every set that I worked on with using video and using any form of video, including straight to hard drive, they create something called the video village. And so the director and the cameraman, the cinematographer, and all the important people are in this tent, maybe a quarter of a mile away from the set. And they're all comfortable sipping lattes, watching the stuff. Whereas the actors and a couple crew guys are out there on the set, totally detached and unconnected. Now, when I grew up as a young man, I was so lucky to be an actor when I was, because it's changing so fast. And in my personal opinion, we're losing a lot of good stuff. And one of the things that I did not do on that set, I said, no video village, none of that crap. And I put myself as the director, if I wasn't in a scene and I was directing it, I put my face right by the lens. So if the actor was playing camera right, I'd be tight, camera left, staring at him. When I grew up, I worked with George Roy Hill in Slaughterhouse-Five, for example. He was right by the lens watching the shot. He was our audience supporting us, and he was right there. And before the shot, you could say, George, wait a minute. What? I don't know what I mean by this, or why do I move there, or whatever you want to say. And he was right there. When the video village stuff happens, you gotta desperately gotta ask a question of the director, and you say, wait, I'm not ready to go. Let me talk to the director. And there's a headset on every crew member, but no actors. So the actors feel like they're the only ones out of the joke. They don't know what's going on. And the crew, the second AD finally says, all right. And he takes his headset off and puts it on your head. And the director, tinny sound, says, what is it? What do you want? What's going on? And you say, oh, forget it. I'll figure it out. I'll just do what I want. I'm not going to worry about it. I mean, it just really hurts things, I think. Another thing that's great about new technology that I love is it, in old film days, you'd do a shot and then they'd say cut, and then everything kind of fell apart and 10, 15 minutes would go by before you were ready to do another take, right? But with straight to hard drive, I said to the operator of the camera operator, I said, when I say cut, don't you cut. If I want you to cut, I'll say cut camera. But when I say cut, that's just for the actors. And we'd stop and the actors would be there. And I'd say, that's great. I love it. Let's go right away again. But this time, take a pause here or whatever I say, and we'd go right away again. You wouldn't lose that momentum. Now, when it came to edit it, of course, it was a pain in the butt because I had all this footage of people between takes, but it was worth it, man. So worth it. And if you run out of the hard drive, you just buy another hard drive for a couple $100.
That's the way I direct. I say, keep the camera rolling.
Yeah.
Let's do it again.
Yeah.
Do it this way.
You shoot cat stuff between the takes. That's wonderful too. Or you say that my favorite is to say cut just to the actors, but I'd say cut. Great. Do it again. Right now. Go again. Yeah. And
that's what I do.
Very often that's the best take of all, the ones where they're already up to speed and they just go again.
Got it. Now, I got to ask you, you did a ton of television.
You did.
Yeah, Riptide probably was one of the most famous because everybody knew Cody Allen on Riptide. But you did Will and Grace and Cold Case. And I love the movie that you did The Day After Tomorrow, where you played president.
Yes.
What was your favorite movie? Was it a movie for television or
A series? Yeah, no, that's a feature film.
Yeah. But which did you enjoy most?
Oh, it's acting. I mean, to me, acting is acting. It's stage, it's film, it's television. It's all the same thing. Even audio. I've done a lot of radio acting. And that, by the way, is the most fun of all, I think, because you don't have to worry about how you look or anything. It's really fun. But it's all the same premise. And the premise is, and the best definition I ever got was I worked in the 70s with James Mason, who was all the great people I've gotten to work with. He was the finest. He was just wonderful, James Mason. So, such a joy and so kind to me. And he treated me almost like I was his son. And he taught me something. When I on the set of This Is Mandingo, the what we were doing. And I had this pamphlet, this big thick book, and I wrote all these notes to myself and I'd pore over them and all this stuff. And one day James Mason said to me, he said, Perry, you really ought to throw that thing away. You know, just throw it away. He said, and this is a book that I would have killed to defend against anybody stealing it or something. And he said, just throw it away. He said, all that stuff, it'll be there. You've thought of it. You've prepared for it. It'll be there in the shot, in the take, in the character, if it should be. He said, but it just gets in your way, all those things. He said, and then he defined acting. He said something that's clearly his definition of acting. And it's so powerful. He said, what we're paid to do, these are his words, what we're paid to do is to believe that what's happening is really happening and has never happened before. He said, it's that simple. He said, it's not easy, but it's simple. Keep it simple. And I trusted that man with my life at that point. Pete said, jump off that cliff. I would have done it without, you know, hesitation. So I took that book that I would have killed to protect and threw it away. And my acting immediately ratcheted up several notches because I was doing just what he said. I was just believing it. That's all. Nothing else. Just believe it. Like a little kid believes it when they play a game, you know?
Gotcha.
Yeah. I had an experience with Peter O'Toole when we had the studio and they were shooting stuntmen and they were using our equipment. And he agreed to come and teach an acting class.
Oh.
And he showed up and he sat down and the first question that was asked to him, he said, was about being an actor. And he just jumped up and he said, I am not an actor. I'm a reactor. I react to the atmosphere. I react to my co-actors.
Right.
I'm a reactor. And
yes.
Remember that you are not an actor. You're a reactor. And cool. You have the obligation to get a reaction from your co-actor. That was brilliant to me.
You remember that movie? What was that movie called about shooting video live television in the 50s with Peter O'Toole? And it's all based on a real story. Ah, what is that called? Wonderful movie. Funny as hell. And he's playing Errol Flynn toward the very end of his career when Flynn was just a drunk. You know, and they hire Flynn to do this television show. And he discovers halfway through rehearsals, he discovers they're going to do it, send it out there live TV back then. You know, they'd send it out live. And Peter O'Toole says, I can't do that. And they say, what are you talking about? And he says, don't you understand? I'm not an actor. I'm a movie star. Isn't that great? What was that movie? God, that's a wonderful movie. I wish I could think of the title of it.
If you think of it, let me know. I'd love to see it. Yeah.
Oh, it's great. There's a lot. It took me most of my career to learn this, even though several people, including Katharine Hepburn once and other people, told me this, but it never registered until I became an old man. But there's a trick to acting, and I use that word intentionally. It's so magically powerful. And instantly puts you in the right place so perfectly that it's literally a trick. And that trick is listen.
Mm.
Listen. Because listening to the other actor or to whatever's going on, even if it's a single of you and you're in the woods, you know, listen. The moment you start to listen, all that crap falls away that you worry about. All the stuff that has nothing to do with believing that what's happening is really happening, you know. And the last thing you think you need to do is listen. You've already heard the other guy's lines 100 times. You've done rehearsals and other takes. You've read the script 100 times, you know. You don't need to listen. So many actors just wait until your mouth stops moving and then they say their line. They haven't heard a word you've said, you know. But if you listen, if you just the way we're listening right now, this is real life, right? And in real life, you have to listen. How do you know what the other person's going to say? How do you even know what you're going to say until you hear yourself say it? That's life. But nobody ever takes that life to film. They work. They think, how am I going to play this line? The hell with how you're going to play that line. What you want to do is listen to the line that creates. And then your line comes out beautifully because it's a response to what they said that you actually listened. It's literally a trick. Every time I get in trouble as an actor on film, and that happens lots because, you know, people it's very rare that things are going well when you're shooting film. Very rare. Most of the time, you're thinking, oh my God, we're in trouble. This is going to be awful for lots of reasons, you know?
But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because when I talk to younger people who want to get into the business of radio and television and interviewing people, or even as a reporter, they say, well, what's the secret to it? I just, just what you said.
Yes.
Listen.
Yes.
I said, you can have bullet points that you're going to ask. You can have questions that you've thought about. But if you don't, if you listen, it'll take you areas that you didn't even think about.
Well, that's exactly why you are such a joy. Mary Jane, I've done so many interviews with you and talked to you so many times. That's why you're such a thrilling joy to, because you listen and ask me the next question based on what I said.
Yeah.
Very few people do that. Very few.
Yeah,
very few.
Absolutely.
It's wonderful, but it's rare.
So I'll take from Perry King and Peter O'Toole, you're a reactor, so listen.
Yeah. I think he's saying the same thing. It's the same, different words saying exactly the same thing. He's reacting, but to react to something, you got to hear it. And, you know, I used to challenge actors, particularly when we were doing Riptide, and you'd be moving so fast, shooting so quickly, and moving on to the next scene. So, and so sometimes I would challenge them by saying something like, you know, if my line was, come on, we got to get out of here before the bad guys get here. Instead, I'd say, come on, let's go, because the elephants are right behind us. And I'd look to see if anybody heard what I said. So often nobody would hear it. Off camera, you know, you do that stuff, you see if you can make them think, whoa, what are you talking about? What? So often they'd say their same line anyway. They didn't hear it.
I love it.
I was shooting them. I used to do Real Stories of the Highway Patrol, all the reenactments, and we had an actress that she's supposed to be crying. Uh-huh. You know, she just couldn't get it. So I walked up to her and I whispered in her ear, I said, you are the worst actress I've ever worked with. Don't ever ask to work with me. And I stepped away and she burst out crying and I got my scene.
That's terrible, Ken.
But she listened.
She heard you.
She heard me.
What happened afterwards, after you got the take?
Oh, I gave her a big hug and I said, of course she'll work for me. You know, you just needed a little, you know, reaction.
Yeah.
Perry, I have to ask you, do you still have a bunch of motorcycles? You're a motorcycle fanatic. I mean, you used to come to the studio all the time on a motorcycle, most of the times, unless the weather was really bad.
I'd ride a motorcycle at least a little bit, I think, just about every day of my life.
I love it. How many do you have?
They propagate in the garage when I'm not looking.
Okay.
No, what happens to me, people always say, oh, you collect motorcycles. And I say, I'm not a collector. I'm not like, and I had great admiration for him, and he's a great guy, but I'm not like Jay Leno or somebody where I collect him. Although Jay uses everything he's got, he runs it. But what happens with me is I have a motorcycle, and then I move on to the next one. Maybe my interests change, and I just park the old one back there in a ways. So they just keep piling up behind me. I got about 30, something like that now. They're mostly old junk. Some of them don't even run anymore because I haven't run them for a while. I'm about to go see a really interesting one. I've been looking for a few years for a really good electric motorcycle. Now, Zero makes some very good ones, but I want something that's really first class off-road, which has to do with suspension and frame geometry and things like that, and yet also a street legal bike. And a friend of mine, who's a great mechanic, built something for a friend of his. He took a Honda 450 off-road, 450, a CRF. I think that's right, 450. And he built, but he took the drivetrain out, the motor and gearbox, and put an electric motor and battery in that. Because I want to be able to ride on my ranch land totally silently so that nobody knows I'm out there, you know? Check the cows and the fences and stuff. And I've had Zeros out there before, Zero motorcycles, which are all electric. And they're very good. They're just not quite up to speed off-road yet, in my opinion. They need to upgrade some stuff still. I'm sorry, Zero. You won't like it if you hear that, but that's how I feel.
So, Perry?
Yeah.
Do you know what the most popular motorcycle in New Mexico is? I'm in New Mexico.
Ah, no.
The Indian.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I'm glad
for
Indian.
Why?
The Indian motorcycle, I'm glad that they've had a great resurgence. People have tried to bring them back. They've, you know, that's a company that failed, you probably know this, back in 1948, I think. And they brought them back.
That's the most popular motorcycle in New Mexico.
Well, they're great bikes, the new one.
The new ones are beautiful.
I think they're made by Polaris. Isn't that the parent company of Indian now, Polaris?
I have not researched it because I'm not allowed to. I'm not allowed to own a motorcycle. So.
No. It says you can't have a motorcycle.
My wife.
Mendy. Okay.
I won't say anything to that. Whatever works, works.
Yeah.
My motorcycle, I had so many damn motorcycles. They're in the living room. They're in the TV room. They're around the swimming pool. And my girlfriend just, you know, she just accepts it. We used to race a motorcycle sidecar rig off-road, and she was the passenger called the monkey in the sidecar.
Wow.
And we won several races, and we'd start a race, and I'd just say to her, I promise you, I won't hurt you. And I only broke that promise once, just a little bit. We hit a berm way too hard, and she went flying up in the air, hanging onto this handle. At one point, her feet were straight up in the air, and she came back down into the sidecar again, thank God, but she hit something with her hip, and she hurt herself a little bit, and she's never let me forget that one. But
I bet not.
And we won our class in the motorcycle sidecar class 4 or 5 times, I think we won.
How long have you been together?
Oh, a long time. We've been together for longer than both of my marriages put together.
Really?
Yeah, which tells me that I'm not good at marriage. That's what I love.
Well, you're good at relationships. How's that?
I don't know. Marriage has never worked out for me.
Well, you see, it maybe you just don't like to be tied down necessarily.
You know, who knows? I don't know. All I know is that I've learned it's good to know what you're good at and what you're bad at, right?
Then stay away from the bad and do the good. Yeah. Right?
That's the lesson from Slaughterhouse-Five, that movie you played at the beginning of this. There's a great, you know, Kurt Vonnegut wrote the book and this. I think he wrote the script too. And there's a great line in it where I won't explain it in detail, but the head character, my father, Billy Pilgrim, goes to another planet, or he's crazy. You never know which. But on this other planet, at least in my father, Billy Pilgrim's mind, he's talking to the chief of the Trafalmadorians, the people who live on this other planet. And if you ever see that movie again, the voice of the Trafalmadorians is the voice of the director, George Roy Hill. What a wonderful voice. He had been an actor, so he used to do that. But the head Trafalmadorian says to Billy Pilgrim, "Mr. Pilgrim, we have determined that the best way to go through eternity is to concentrate on the good times and ignore the bad."
Isn't that great?
And there's so much truth in that.
Talking about names, Perry, is it true that Roger Sherman was a signatory to the United States Declaration of Independence and that was your ancestor?
Yes, he is my ancestor. He's the only one, I think, that signed all 4 of the founding documents.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he signed the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Confederation, which was the Articles of Confederation, preceded the Constitution by 9 years. You know what's forgotten? He signed it. I also have another relative, an ancestor, that signed the Declaration of Independence named John Morton. And all those people that signed that document, one of the things we forget sort of conveniently in our American history is by signing that document, they were signing their death warrant if we lost.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we were going to lose because we were coming up against the greatest standing army in the world at the time.
Yeah.
The chances of our winning were infinitesimally small. I mean, they almost didn't exist. But our revolution proves that the people who fight from their own kitchens, they always win because it matters more to them. But anyway, those guys, think how brave they were, particularly John Hancock. That's why he makes that big flourish when John Hancock signs his name on the, because he's saying, come on, come and get me.
Bring it on.
They were dead men if we lost. They were dead.
Yeah. Yeah. But they believed in what we were doing. And, you know, we have to get some of that spirit back, Perry, unfortunately. You know, we're so separated. We're so polarized today. And that scares me. We've got to come together because in coming together, we can win. No matter what it is, we can win. But when you're divided, not good.
You know, as George Clooney says, we've been in tough spots before and we've always come through this nation. and we're the beacon of freedom for the whole world, and we're in danger of losing it. And if we can successfully hang on to it, and again, I think we'll be stronger than ever. It's not a foregone conclusion. We might lose it. But if we don't lose it, that's what I saw in Watergate. I was a college kid in the late 60s, right? And all of us at college thought, no, this place doesn't work. We need to burn the country to the ground and start over, we thought. And then Watergate happened. And in Watergate, and a wonderful trial with that extraordinary man, Senator Sam Ervin, remember him?
Mm-hmm. God, mm-hmm.
Man, wonderful man presiding over that trial. But we did something that never happened in history, our country did. We took the most powerful man in the world, Richard Nixon, took him out of power, found him guilty, and essentially put him in prison if he hadn't gotten that bogus pardon. And by taking that pardon, he was admitting his guilt, you know. And we did all that without firing a shot. Now, that was incredible. So with luck, we can solve this one, too. I think this might be a more serious threat than Watergate, but we'll see. That old wish, may you live in interesting times. Well, we sure got our wish, didn't we?
Just out of curiosity, how do you feel about this whole thing with the First Amendment, free speech? Are we getting to a point where free speech is...
I at this point, because I'm so worried about all of that, free speech and freedom and habeas corpus and
due process,
exactly, all of that. I mean, all of that is being trampled right now, and I feel very strongly that we have to fight. I'm very excited about Newsom because he seems to be one of the only Democrats that's actually fighting, not just talking, fighting back. It's critical that we fight back. I think Jimmy Kimmel, I'm sure you guys saw his speech from last night. It was wonderful. It was perfectly, he did a superb job, I thought.
Yeah, we just have to hold on to what we believe and know that this country is all about, you know.
Not letting people say what they want to say is un-American. That's why the whole world loves us, because it loves that part of us, I should say. They don't love us. Yeah. They really don't love us right now. But that's what the world loves about us, is the idea that you can say what you want.
Yeah. What's next for Perry King? Any new projects? I know you're retired, sort of.
Yeah, that's what I think of myself. I thought after I made that film, The Divide, I was so happy with that experience. The film is very flawed. Got a lot of things wrong. Could talk for hours about the mistakes I made. And they're all my mistakes because I was in charge. But the experience was so satisfying. At the end of it, my partner, Jana Brown, who wrote it, and I felt that we had, you know, with all its flaws, we had made the movie we meant to make. And that really is the only time I've ever felt that way. And so I thought, perfect time to quit. I'm an old guy. Go see what life's like without acting. And I think I picked a very good time to get out because the business is in turmoil right now, as you guys undoubtedly know. It's in big trouble. It's trying to reassess itself and redefine itself and find new business models that make it pay. I think Hollywood is very possible that 20, 30, 40 years from now, people will look back and say, right now it was the end of Hollywood as the center of movie making. Hollywood has screwed itself up so bad. New Mexico, again, is where a lot of filmmaking is moving, and it's because they make it attractive to do it out there.
Yeah. And you could attest to that.
Well, New Mexico is, I'm born and raised in New Mexico. Started in the film, I was a part of the first film initiative. But, you know, everybody talks about New Mexico's in the film. You know, we got 8-9 movies productions going on any given day in Hollywood. You still have 300 plus projects going. So,
well, I don't know what the numbers are, but if we had 300 in the past, we've only got 100 today. There's so much less film, and I know that from talking to everybody, and I also know it from just when you just drive around LA. You know, it used to be you'd see production vehicles all over the place, and now you just don't. Nobody's shooting. Nobody's doing anything. The streaming companies have found that their business model is not working. The networks are collapsing. The independent films are struggling. Dollars not worth anything. We got so many. Yeah. COVID and those two strikes, and then AI, the threat of AI, all that's just...
Oh, gosh, yes.
Well, my son is a DP. My daughter is a showrunner. They live in Nashville right now, and they got so much work.
Good. Great. I'm glad to hear it.
But they got to go to Atlanta. They got to go to...
Well, that's what I'm saying. Hollywood. Hollywood is...
Like Hollywood, yeah. They both worked in Hollywood and moved back, you know, but Nashville is just, you know, really... And they don't have any incentives like we do. But I'm hopeful, you know, my business model has kind of changed is that I'm doing mockumentaries. You know, we're firing up mockumentaries.
Yeah. There's plenty of stuff for that, I'm telling you.
Well, because with a mockumentary, it's a lot cheaper to do. And we don't have to build sets. We'll just go to a location, use the location to do the story, you know, and do the mockumentary. And, I mean, it sounds comical, mockumentary, but we're doing some serious projects.
That's cool.
But it's done like a documentary story. The story is.
Well, as always, Ken, and Perry, we always run out of time. I've got to ask you, Perry, please, will you come back again?
Oh, anytime, Mary Jane, for you. I love talking to you. I always love it. I was part of something just a couple of days ago that happens periodically called Dinner with Dreamers. And you get together 25 people or so around a dinner table. And it's just everybody who has dreams helping and cross-pollinating others. And I so often at that thing, I find myself saying, look, I'm on the tail end of probably, because most of them are very young. And I say, I'm on the other end of this, but I can help you maybe by just telling you some of the things that I learned that worked for me. And I tell them a story, and I know I've told you this story, about meeting a wonderful actor named Claude Rains when I was a boy.
Mm.
And Claude Rains, of all the generous people in show business that I've met, he changed my life. He saved my life. And he said to me, I won't go through the whole story, but at the end of spending an afternoon with him and learning about acting and his career, I said, what's the most important thing, Mr. Rains, for me to remember? You know, I'm 15 and I know I want to be an actor, but he knew that I needed something, a leg up, help. And at his door saying goodbye to him, and he's very old. He gave me an afternoon of his life when he only had a handful of those left, and he knew it. So generous. But anyway, this is what he said to me. And I got to imitate him because I can hear his voice. He said, the most important thing is enthusiasm. Boom. And he closed the door in my face, right? He knew by doing that, every actor knows your exit's the most important thing you do. And he just branded that word into my head. And you, anybody I know in the world, you have enthusiasm. That's what you, and you know better than anybody, including me. It's utterly incredible what you can accomplish and what you can get through and pave over with just slathering enthusiasm on, like you're putting butter on a piece of toast. It's just amazing. And most of the time, you know, you show up at a set at 5 in the morning, you're exhausted, everybody's grumpy, the script stinks, the director is just a traffic cop, the actors don't care about each other. You know, you got so many problems. And if you just go in and say, oh, we could do great stuff today, you watch. The whole thing lifts up in the air.
I love it. Perry, you are the best. You're a caring, good heart friend. And I'm honored to call you my friend. And we will definitely have you back. We just have to. This is to be continued.
Anytime. I'm retired. I got lots of free time now.
I love you. I love you. Well, that's another segment of Pop Star Talk with many more to come. So please share your stories with family and friends about these wonderful people like Perry that you've met on Pop Star Talk from the big and the small screen. So till next time, Ken, Greg, our engineer, Perry, I'm Mary Jane Pop wishing you much happiness. And remember, it all begins with live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and of course, dare to dream.
Produced by AutoVita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.